We're talking about filing state income taxes on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. It is down to the wire. Today is the deadline for filing both federal and state income tax payments. The date was extended to provide some economic and logistical cushion for taxpayers who, as you recall, in April, were in the throes of pandemic stay-at-home orders, school closures, the shuttered businesses, and taxpayers must file or get an extension by tonight's deadline or face a penalty. So what questions do you have for the head of our state's tax collection agency? What do you want him to know? What questions do you have about refunds, about audits, appeals, other parts of the process? We're at 800-642-1234. Diane Hart is administrator of the Wisconsin Department of Revenue's Division of Income, Sales, and Excise Tax. Diane, welcome to the Ideas Network. Hi, Diane, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi,
I'm here.
Good morning.
Hi. And we also
have Peter Barca with us, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Secretary Barca, welcome back.
Well, good morning, Kate. Great to be back on your show again on a very important day.
A very important day for your agency. How has this extended tax deadline affected tax collections this year?
Well, I'll kick it off just by saying, well, obviously the most important thing is it's sort of delayed people's obligations to file so that in the middle of a pandemic, they could have more time to gather their information. And even for practitioners who, you know, during the period the taxes were due, we're all scrambling to be safer at home and getting their systems down pat. It gave them extra time as well. Obviously, from the state perspective, it delayed our ability to collect the resources normally you get in April 15th for, you know, another 3 months. But by and large, we hear good feedback. I think it's gone pretty well and sort of spread out that time period. And so far, so good with less than a day left here.
Yeah, Secretary, will the later filing date affect agencies or budgeting at all? What does it mean to cash flow?
Well, that's the biggest issue, obviously, is it does affect cash flow because, you know, we expected, you know, this revenue in on April 15th, and now it's delayed it for 3 months. But it's a one-time cash flow issue because after today, then we're back on track and we'll have the money. So it's just, you know, basically that three-month period that we had to scramble and, you know, the comptroller's office, I had to move money around. But we've gotten through it, and we'll see where we end up.
Diane Hart, give us some context as to the traffic in the revenue department. How many people in Wisconsin still haven't filed their state taxes?
We still have about 160,000 taxpayers that will be filing today. And we believe most of them are people who owe. So the people that have refunds coming, they were able to get their returns filed by April 15th or between April 15th and July 15th.
Is that pretty typical to have that many filers waiting until the last hours?
Yes, pretty typical for those that owe. They usually wait till that last day.
Do you have any idea how much revenue is still outstanding based on the projections of how many, you know, people are left to file?
Well, not really, and we'll know in a couple of weeks here, but we have to wait until those returns come in and we see what checks are attached to them.
You know, how many refunds have been processed up to this point?
About 2.83 million returns have been filed, and almost, you know, a large part of those are refunds. About 2.34 million are refunds year to date.
And is that number of refunds pretty typical? Is that average?
It's average. It's pretty typical. Last year we had 2.35 million refunds compared to 2.34 million refunds right now. So.
And Diane, what time of day is the deadline for filing electronically to avoid potential late penalties?
What kind of day? Well,
or what time? Yeah.
What time?
Yes.
Well, today we'll get a lot of returns in, and many of them will be paper returns because our balance due returns, a lot of times people
with, which is primarily lower limb. More than 75% of patients with lower limb amputation end up getting a prosthesis. The number is lower with upper limb So I read a study yesterday. I was trying to brush up on numbers for you. With lower limb amputation, the number is somewhere between 50 and 95% of patients with lower limb amputations get fitted with prostheses. I think the technology has advanced to a point where patients are very, very successful with lower limb amputation or prosthetics fittings. And so they're usually generally aware of what's out there and can make a go of it to get fitted with a prosthesis and make use of it and have a healthy lifestyle and a successful rehabilitative outcome with a lower limb prosthesis.
What type of patient makes a good candidate for a prosthetic limb?
Somebody with a lot of determination. I mean, we see such a wide range of patients at UW Health with amputations. I deal with everything from infants to, I think my oldest patient to date is 96. Somebody who has the wherewithal to understand what it takes to put one on and to have the determination to use it, I think is the biggest factor. Obviously, we need a healthy limb. Without a healthy limb and a well-healed limb, we can't do anything because we'd be doing more harm than good. But once the limb is fully healed, which generally happens between 6 weeks for really, really healthy folks and more like 12 weeks for less healthy folks, we can start fitting the device and take a plaster mold of their limb. And it's before all of that happens, we're having routine conversations with their doctor about what the prescription is, what the patient wants to get out of having a prosthesis. It's all a very measured continuum of care.
Let's take a call now. Bob is joining us from Appleton. Hi, Bob. Oh, and Bob is no longer there. I want to ask you about the technology and how it's changed. I know when my mom, her leg was amputated due to vascular disease, and that first prosthetic she received late 90s, around 2000, was so heavy. And it was, if I dare say the word, clunky. And then, you know, a decade or almost two went by, and you know, subsequent prosthetics were so much lighter. What has changed about the technology?
Sure. I'm sorry to hear that from her. It's not an unusual thing for patients to ask about the weight of a device. By far the most common level of amputee we fit, I can say probably across the nation by far, is a below the knee or a transtibial level amputee. Was that the level she had?
Yes.
Okay. So the average weight for just an average size person, the device probably weighs between 2¾ pounds to 4.5 pounds, which doesn't sound like a lot of weight, in my opinion. And if you hold it out from your body, may or may not feel heavy to you. But it certainly doesn't feel the same as what was once attached to your body, and that's for pretty obvious reasons. What we have now to work with, though, are acrylic and fiberglass resins. We have titanium and aluminum components, which are very, very lightweight. The connections between the socket, the part that fits on the body, and the foot that's replacing the foot you know, one had. All of those connections are made as lightweight as possible, and the feet themselves are many times made of carbon fiber, which is extremely lightweight.
We're talking about limb loss and prosthetic limbs with UW Health certified prosthetist Amy Polios. Do you have a prosthetic limb? How long have you had it, and how many times have you had it replaced? Do you have questions about the technology of these limbs? What about socket liners and the care of the skin? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Amy Polios right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about limb loss here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and This topic hits home for me as my mom was an amputee for decades of her life. I saw in her sheer grit, sheer determination to work through the pain, the soreness, the skin care, all to walk on her own for as long as possible. But that second amputation, that second leg amputation, was so much more difficult. Do you have an amputee in your life? What can you tell us about their journey with prosthetics? What have you learned from them? Join in 800-642-1234. Prosthetist Amy Polios is with us with the Orthotics and Prosthetics Clinic at UW Health. Let's take a call now. Joe is joining us from Neenah this morning. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Good morning. I'm 68 years old. I am a type 2 diabetic, and I do feel diabetic neuropathy in my lower limbs, my legs. And I cope with it. There's no problem with skin issues or anything like that. But it seems like each year it builds up. I'm just wondering, when do you get to a point where you have to make a decision that your legs do have to be amputated? What's going to be the telling factor on that?
Good morning, Joe. Calling from my hometown, actually, of Neenah. So I would say that that's a surgical decision and one that you would have to have with your surgical team. If the health of the limb is intact and there's no skin breakdown, there's no consistent, you know, open skin issues, infection, that would be, is it pain that you're talking about specifically, Joe?
Well, it's kind of funny to classify it as pain. I could put my legs in cold water and they actually feel warm. They do tingle a little bit, but as I move around and everything, the sensation goes away. It's not so much as pain. It's worse more at night when they're kind of not doing anything. So I'm just wondering how much of a timeline I may have on this.
Well, that's a fantastic question. Have you ever had a vascular study done where they use an ultrasound and test the flow of blood flow through your feet?
No, I haven't.
Okay, that would be the first step, is definitely engaging a conversation with a vascular doctor. They would do an ultrasound study, test what kind of blood flow is going through your feet, and which is the main reason for the sensation loss and that tingling and the loss of nerve action that you're having in your feet. And that would be the very, very first thing. You know, that would be something to do today, tomorrow, this week, because chances are, if you're dealing with that kind of diabetic neuropathy, blood flow challenges may already exist and you may not know it, but there are surgeries that may help open up those lines and get things working better before it would result in a need for an amputation. So I would definitely talk to your primary care doctor and get a referral to a vascular team who can take a good look at your blood flow and test what that is like before a small issue becomes a larger one.
Joe, thank you so much for calling in with your situation. Amy, let's look at socket liners for a moment and the place where the prosthetic is attached to the actual skin. How have socket liners evolved and that area that is so sensitive?
Sure. So we have a wonderful resource called gel liners, and I'm not sure if your mother was fit with one of these, Kate, or not, but gel liners are made from a huge variety of materials, silicone, thermoplastic elastomer. There's different materials that can be combined. There's all these different recipes that the manufacturers make them out of now, but it's essentially a very soft, a clingy gel, which gets reflected inside out and then rolled onto the residual limb, which essentially performs as another very cushiony layer of skin. And what it does is it prevents shear or movement of the skin from rubbing the inside of the socket, the more rigid part of the construction of the device. And it cushions the skin, makes it so that it's insulated essentially, and prevents skin breakdown. My career started in the early 2000s, 2001, and we already had plenty of options for these gel liners at that time, but that wouldn't have been the case in the early 90s. So perhaps that was not your mother's experience, but gel liners have been a godsend for prosthetists everywhere because whereas you couldn't prevent skin breakdown by just simple use of a sock or a foam liner of sorts, which was all they had years before, we have a myriad of choices now.
But in terms of the breathability of these liners, if the skin is sweating and there isn't that ability to breathe through that liner, is that an issue?
Yeah, no, that's the one drawback, is that they are hot. I don't wear one myself, and I don't pretend to understand what that feels like, but I do compare it to wearing socks on my feet in the middle of a 80-degree summer day. I would prefer not to. Generally speaking, though, the benefits outweigh the negatives, and patients' skin does adapt over time. It sort of somehow gets used to being confined or sealed off within those gel liner layers. At first, when patients wear them, they peel them off and they drip of perspiration. But over time, the skin does adapt.
We're talking with Amy Palios, who is a prosthetist with the Orthotics and Prosthetics Clinic at UW Health. She specializes in lower limb amputations, and we're looking at limb loss this hour. Do you have questions about the technology of prosthetic limbs? If you have had an amputation, what kind of physical therapy was involved in your recovery after surgery, and how long did it take for you to get used to wearing that limb? Join in at 800-642-1234. Amy, how soon after surgery can you start working with a patient on getting that limb fitted?
Well, my job oftentimes with the patient starts before surgery. That's one of the benefits of being within the UW health system or a big healthcare system, is that I often do get to meet the patients before the surgery happens, or I'm at least interacting with surgeons that know they have a patient coming up who's going to experience an amputation. But acute care includes those first few days and weeks right after surgery, where our team, sometimes myself, sometimes a colleague who works inpatient, will see the patient for some compression garments and a protective cast to protect the limb while it heals. So it can start before amputation surgery, or certainly within days after. At an outpatient clinic, most prosthetists will see an amputee anywhere between 2 and 6 weeks post-surgery, and that's to evaluate the limb, make sure that it's getting the proper compression. Compression is essential to help healing the limb and getting edema or swelling out of the residual limb and getting it shaped to get it ready for the fitting, which begins between 6 weeks, which is really aggressive, and more like 10 or 12 weeks for our diabetic population, which might take a little longer to heal.
What does that compression do in terms of shaping that limb post-surgery?
So generally, obviously blood flow wants to help heal the wound, and gravity, because of the way it works, if somebody's sitting upright, gravity wants to pull all that fluid downwards. Compression applied to the limb helps blood flow circulate back to the heart, gets rid of that edema, and gets the soft tissue under control, which has sort of taken the shape of whatever the surgeon made it do. I mean, we see all kinds of surgical results of patients put back together in traumatic situations. The surgeons are dealing with what they're given, and in some traumatic accidents, that's not a planned surgery. So they're putting somebody back together and doing a patchwork of a sewing job, and they do as well as they can. But then compression helps that limb shape down to more of an anatomical normal. And that's when once the swelling is completely gone, it's when we can begin casting for the device.
And when you begin casting for the device, are devices by and large quite similar for lower limbs, or do you modify based on the person?
Oh, they're all custom made. We take a plaster mold of a patient's residual limb in the office when they're fully healed, when we have a prescription to proceed. And no two look alike. I have a variety of models that sit in the back lab. I sometimes save the ones that are really, really from very, very unique or difficult fittings in case that patient would need something in the future. And they all look completely different. I mean, you can have a 125-pound woman's cast next to a 225-pound man's cast, and they would look quite different. So that everything is custom done that's fit on the body. Now, below that, the components that we order are from the manufacturers already made. So those components are being ordered that absolutely do look alike.
Yeah, so those components that are below that custom mold have a lot of the same technology.
Correct.
We are talking with certified prosthetist Amy Polios this hour about amputation and the process of fitting an artificial limb. What questions do you have about this process, the physical therapy? Are you curious about how doctors and patients choose when it's time to amputate a limb? Has a pandemic caused you disruptions and difficulties in getting fitted for a new prosthetic limb? And what is this journey like for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up on prosthetic limbs, maybe hear from you right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Here with us as we talk about limb loss here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Amputation can totally change how someone sees themselves, and it may come with major self-esteem issues. Some companies, some designers make something called expressive prostheses. These are prosthetic limbs that don't focus on blending in and hiding the amputation, but instead having fashionable designs that can be customized. How do you feel about your prosthetic limb? Do you have phantom pains? What was it like for you to accept the amputation? What helped you through this painful experience? Join in 800-642-1234. Amy Polios is a certified prosthetist with the Orthotics and Prosthetics Clinic at UW Health, where she specializes in lower limb amputations. Amy, explain for us what the physical therapy process is like when you start to rehabilitate with that prosthetic limb.
Sure. Well, oftentimes we see patients get engaged with physical therapists while they're still in the hospital, because obviously life is completely altered when you leave the hospital and go home. The therapist in the hospital makes sure the patient can safely transfer from the hospital bed to a wheelchair, or sometimes be up with a walker. So that initial or acute care phase is just all about safety, but continuing to move. Years back, patients were allowed to just sit in a chair for 6 to 8 weeks before they got going. That's no longer the case. Physical therapists are pretty aggressive in getting people up and moving right away. And that oftentimes helps us predict how well they're going to do with a prosthesis. But as far as the gait training, we call it, once they get their prosthesis, that generally begins right after they receive their prosthesis, which again can be between the 6 and 12 week postoperative mark. And right when they are being fitted is when they are also referred to a physical therapist to begin getting that strength back that they had to stand and engage those glute and hamstring muscles in their quadriceps, to straighten their knee if they have a knee unit or a knee joint, straighten their hip if they are above the knee amputee, and learn how to use those muscles that are remaining to control what they no longer have left.
What is it like when you see someone with that amputation standing for the first time with that prosthetic?
It's so gratifying. You know, it doesn't get old. I remind myself, because I've been doing this for a while now, I mean, I guess almost 20 years, it never gets old. I still don't lose that like heart rate rise when I see my patients get up and walk for the first time. It's why I get up and go to work every day. And one of the best things is when we fit somebody who I've only ever seen to come into the office in a wheelchair, and weeks later they return and they come in using a walker, or they're using crutches, or sometimes, incredibly, they're not using a gait aid at all. It's pretty special.
Let's take another call. Lonnie is with us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Lonnie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a son
late 30s that has had a Syme's amputation in the late 90s. So he's lived with this, 20 some years. Currently uses a foam liner. So Syme's amputation is obviously the foot. They roll the heel pad up and maintain the heel pad. He's experienced a lot of atrophy, had fasciotomies on both sides of his calf. So they removed a lot of the calf muscle. So his leg is very thin on the lower half, below the knee. He currently uses a foam liner, is extremely active, and experiences some intermittent skin breakdown. I heard discussion on the gel liners. I just barely caught the tail end of that discussion on radio. Just wondering, any other suggestions for an extremely active individual in this case, and I guess, best place to get a gel liner fitted is normal.
Yeah, Lonnie, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Lonnie, for bringing that situation. Amy, what would you suggest?
So a lot of really good questions there. Good morning, Lonnie. Good to hear from you. Yeah, Syme's amputees tend to be extremely active, and that's so good to hear. But yeah, they also, because they're so active, tend to have skin issues because of perspiration within the prosthesis. So a couple things. A gel liner is something that can't be introduced into the same type of prosthetic system after the fact. The prosthesis actually has to be made around that interface. So you can't, for example, we would change our socks within shoes. You can't introduce a gel liner to the inside of the fitting of a prosthetic socket. It has to be an integral part of the system from the get-go. But we often do use gel liners within Syme's prostheses. So it would be something that perhaps in a future device could be brought up with his prosthetist as to whether that is an option. Another thing, we have various socks, and I'm curious, I don't know if I can still ask Lonnie a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Lonnie, do you know if your son uses some sort of a sock within his P-Lite or his foam insert within the prosthesis?
Yes, I know, like you say, he has a lot of perspiration, especially in the summer, being active. But yes, he wears socks. Seems to me he had some so-called gel socks. So I obviously that'd be different than a gel liner. I honestly have not seen those, so.
Yeah, and those are very, very hot as well. A gel sock is essentially a thinner, more flexible version of a gel liner, and they also do get really, really hot and sweaty and a bit stinky, if I may say. It's just like wearing anything on your feet, because that is his foot, and his limb extends all the way down to his ankle. So my first suggestion is for him to return to his prosthetist with this concern, because that won't come as a surprise to the provider that he's having perspiration or skin issues. That's just such a common thing that we see. But there are socks that are made with silver fabric, and that wicks away moisture and provides an interface that's a little bit more skin friendly. So the socks he already has may come in a silver fiber weave, which does a little bit better with perspiration and odor and wicking away moisture. There are also, I see a ton of dermatological issues with people's residual limbs at times, and it's all because of sweat and buildup of that. But so I guess this is a conversation that has to be had with his provider. Can a sock change be introduced to the system that he has? Can a future prosthetic that he gets fitted with include a gel liner interface? I haven't fit a ton of Syme's amputees with gel liners because they tend to be bulky, and bulk is one thing you're sort of always fighting when you're making a prosthesis for somebody. But that said, if he's having skin breakdown, the gel liner might be a great option.
Lonnie, thank you for the call. We're with Amy Polios, who is a certified prosthetist with the Orthotics and Prosthetics Clinic at UW Health, and we're talking about amputations, limb loss, and your journey as well. Do you have a prosthetic limb? How long have you had it, and how many times have you had it replaced? What kind of prosthetic technology should engineers focus on? Join in at 800-642-1234. Amy, over a course of someone's amputation, you know, how might they go about changing to a new technology or a new prosthetic? What is that like?
Sure. So the technology is ever changing, and we get a lot of questions from people who have been shopping online and see various articles and within their support networks. And I think that's fantastic. It's our job to know what's out there. It's our job to know what's available and whether it's appropriate for a patient. And a lot of times we'll have a discussion with the patient, with the doctor, with the physical therapist, and talk about what's right for them. When somebody gets an amputation, one of the first things they should be told in their education postoperatively is that they're not going to have just one device. They're going to have many over the course of their life. In the first 3 years or so of an amputee's life, they generally are fitted with at least two prosthetic limbs. And that's because the residual limb or the anatomy changes so much in those first few months and years that they're in need of a socket change. So generally speaking, the very first socket they get doesn't generally fit for more than, say, 3, 6, 9 months, because the anatomy changes so rapidly in that first period. And they're also hopefully getting more proficient at moving around. They're up on their feet more. They're getting more active. And so we go from what we call a preparatory or a temporary prosthesis to a definitive, which means like a training leg, essentially, to a more permanent device. And when we do that jump, we generally increase the technology or the level of activity with the components that are available. So it's something that they're going to use long term to achieve whatever goals they have. And then in time, over the years, their needs may change. You know, something that they thought they needed in that first year may become wholly different if they return to work, or perhaps they retire and they're not doing as much. So those needs determine what type of technology they need as far as a foot or a knee is concerned.
We're talking with prosthetist Amy Polios, our guide this hour to limb loss, the world of prosthetics. Has the pandemic changed your issues with your prosthetic limb? Has the coronavirus shut down or pushed back an amputation surgery? What kind of technology are you looking at in your prosthetic? What have you learned about yourself or your loved one since the amputation? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this in a minute with Amy Polios here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at prosthetics this hour and the devices to walk again. Advanced robotics, bionic limbs, microchips could all be the prosthetic technology of the future. Do you have questions about the technology of prosthetic limbs? What causes your limb to function well one day but not the next? It's 800-642-1234. Amy Polios is a prosthetist at UW Health, and she stays with us. Let's take another call now. Ruth is joining us from Prescott. Hi, Ruth.
Hello. I have a story of hope. My mother had an amputated leg at age 99 at the Mayo Clinic. She was not able to adjust to a prosthetic leg. So she adjusted with just using the muscles in the upper thigh, and she did very, very well. No pain, no phantom pain, and she did live the rest of her life when she died at 102 in a wheelchair. But she had an excellent physical therapist, and I think that they are the key, plus the attitude of success that that physical therapy and her family members gave her to adjust to the rest of her life in a wheelchair.
Wow, Ruth, what a story. And it is so awe-inspiring to learn about her story and that amputation giving her a life beyond that, Amy.
Yeah, that's wonderful, Ruth. I'm so happy to hear it. It's absolutely true that not everybody is an appropriate candidate for a prosthesis, nor does that mean success or not. I mean, we have such a variety of conversations with patients after amputation surgery about what their needs and desires are. And it may not include a prosthesis. It may just include postoperative care or sometimes just a protective device to keep that residual limb safe. But it doesn't mean that somebody is unsuccessful if they don't desire to use a prosthesis. Sometimes the level of amputation, the age of the patient, what they need to be able to get out of it doesn't require some device to be made, but more of counseling. And I think Ruth is spot on when she says attitude is everything, because it is. It's the attitude of the patient and the right physical therapy team has everything to do with the outcome of a successful prosthetic or an amputation surgery, rather.
How do support groups fit into this?
They're just incredibly important. When I talk to patients and counsel them, either prior to or after surgery, I'm very careful not to ever say, I understand what you're going through, because I have never experienced an amputation, and it would not be fair for me to say that, no matter how many prosthetic devices I've made for them. But I do everything I can to help coordinate them to meet another patient who's been through it, hopefully somebody in their age range and with the same amputation level. Because when my patients can talk to somebody who's been through it and can see that life goes on and can see the variety of things that people are able to do or how they do them, that is incredibly important. There's a national organization called the Amputee Coalition of America that is very, very well respected and an incredible resource to new amputees or existing amputees. They have a peer support network that is available by phone or by email, and people can reach out and obtain contact information for certified peer visitors, they're called. So it's essentially somebody who can give a patient a phone call or even locally come and see new patients at the hospital to provide counsel and answer questions. And they're very well trained in what information to give out and maybe what not to say, because that's equally important. There are no two stories that are the same, and we have to be very careful that what somebody anticipates happening to them isn't based on just one other person's story.
We have less than a minute left, but I'm wondering if you could leave us with what you would say to someone who is preparing for that amputation surgery.
Sure. Well, I'm an optimist by nature. It's what I do. What I tend to focus on is the outcome of what is available. And generally speaking, below the knee amputation leads somebody to live a very active, healthy, new normal life. And we can do remarkable things to help them resume their quality of life, but they have to have the desire to do it. So I think in the past decades, that may not have been the case where you could resume your normal activity level, but that's absolutely possible now. And so I would encourage them to be hopeful and determined and make it whatever they want to happen after surgery, we can work together and help them to make that happen.
Amy, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Amy Palios is a certified prosthetist with the Orthotics and Prosthetics Clinic at UW Health, where she specializes in lower limb amputations and prosthetics. tribal communities in Wisconsin haven't seen a spike in COVID-19 cases like in some other parts of the country, but Native Americans are among the groups at higher risk for contracting the virus and complications that go along with it. As cases have surged across the state, tribes are remaining vigilant. Danielle Kading has more.
Here for COVID testing? I'm going to have you go right.
Amanda Rex's car is lining up for a drive-through testing event in Red Cliff. Larry and Alice Derrigan have been waiting in line for about an hour. The two are members of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and they wanted to get tested just to be safe. He's 80 and she's 76 years old.
I have a heart problem and I have high blood pressure and I'm a diabetic. So she's healthier than I am.
I don't really have blood pressure or anything like that, but I've had a couple little problems with my heart, but nothing serious.
But they are serious about taking precautions like doing daily temperature checks and wearing masks. They stick pretty close to home. Both are concerned because they know they're at higher risk, and coronavirus cases have grown since the state opened up. That's why testing is so important, according to Red Cliff Tribal Chairman Rick Peterson.
Testing is going to be a huge part of learning that, if anybody within the community has it. And then proper precautions can be taken to contain it.
A number of factors place Native Americans at higher risk for the virus, according to Jessica Atwell. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist with the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health. Those include large families living under one roof or high rates of underlying health conditions.
So things like diabetes and heart disease. So when those conditions are present on top of the environmental factors, it can lead to increased risk.
In Wisconsin, Native Americans have higher rates of diabetes than the overall population. Joan Delabrew says diabetes is common on her reservation. She's the chairwoman for the governing body of the Menominee Tribe. Health rankings show Menominee County, where her tribe is located, has the worst outcomes statewide. And Delabrew says the vast majority of their roughly 9,000 members are aging.
We can have one or two, sometimes three generations living in the same household. So you have a wide variance of ages, a high variance of risk factors, and they're all in the same household, so COVID could be very devastating.
The Menominee Tribe worked with the Stockbridge-Muncie community and National Guard to conduct mass testing in May. Delabrew says that was key for their reopening plans because the tribe's clinic didn't have the capability to test that many people due to limited supplies from Indian Health Service. The federal agency's Bemidji Area Director, Daniel Fry, says tribal members in the region are being tested at a higher rate than the rest of the country.
Although there were some difficulties with testing at the forefront, we have multiple platforms to test now.
He points to rapid tests that have been provided to every tribe in Wisconsin and support from the state to conduct testing. Indian Health Service has also distributed around $31 million to the state's 11 tribes through the CARES Act and other coronavirus funding. Fry feels the agency's response has been adequate. But tribal advocates say the agency has been historically underfunded. Spending has increased in recent years, but the amount of money spent on care for individuals is less than other federal programs like Medicare and Medicaid. Atwell, the epidemiologist with Johns Hopkins, says there needs to be a better grasp of the longstanding racial and health disparities among tribal communities.
And resource limitations that put these at greater risk for pandemics like this one and have done so in the past and will do so in the future unless we can work together to address those underlying challenges.
Tribal health advocates are urging Congress to provide more funding to help tribes with coronavirus response in its next relief package. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.